This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This is Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from What I Came to Tell You by Tommy Hayes. Chapter 1. Not Him Again. Before their mother became Buddhist, she would take Grover and his sister to the First Presbyterian Church downtown. The minister talked about God being everywhere. Omnipresent was the word he liked to use. But what Grover believed more and more, if you could call it believing, was the omnipresence of absence, the everywhere of gone. The feeling was with Grover as he and his sister, Sudi, walked out of the bamboo forest and headed up Edgemont Road toward the cemetery. Between them, they carried a stiff weaving that glinted with autumn leaves Grover had carefully worked between tied sections of bamboo. Biscuit, their little mutt dog, followed them. It was a chilly Saturday afternoon in October, 6 months and 2 days since the dog's leash had snapped and sent Grover's family reeling. The cool breeze picked up, tugging on the weaving. Grover glanced at Sudi to make sure she had a good grip. Lately, it seemed that his sister, who had turned 10 in September, looked more and more like their mother, with her high cheekbones and winter blue eyes. Grover, who was 12, knew all too well that he'd been looking more and more like their father. Whenever he found himself in front of a mirror, he saw a skinny, stoop-shouldered kid, weighed down by his father's caterpillar eyebrows. A sudden gust of wind pushed on the weaving. "Hold on," Grover said. Sudi held her end with both hands. Grover's eyes lingered on his sister's face. The first sign of tears, and he was taking her right back to the house. "What?" she asked. "Nothing." The wind died the moment they entered the wrought-iron cemetery gates, as if they'd stepped into a room. Riverside, the city's oldest cemetery, was where the writer Thomas Wolfe was buried. Wolfe, who some people, especially if they weren't from Asheville, hadn't heard of, had once been as famous as Ernest Hemingway or William Faulkner or F. Scott Fitzgerald. He'd written several long books, the most famous being Look Homeward, Angel. Riverside was also where, 20 years ago, Grover's parents had met. Grover's father had been a tour guide for the Thomas Wolfe House before he became its director. Grover's mother had been a student in a college English class that was studying Wolfe's novels, and their father had taken them on a tour of Riverside. "If it wasn't for Thomas Wolfe," their father liked to remind Grover and Sudi, "they wouldn't even exist." Grover's parents had held their wedding in Riverside and bought an old house on the edge of the cemetery. Their father had wanted to be close to Wolfe and all the other historic graves. Their mother had liked the view from their large upstairs bedroom window. More like a park with headstones, Riverside stretched across 87 acres of rolling hills and thick-trunked oaks and tulip poplars. Their mother had set up her little Buddhist altar so that every morning as she meditated, she looked out on the cemetery. Carrying the weaving, Grover and Sudi walked over one hill, passing the Jewish section. They heard the scrape of a shovel. A man with long gray hair, a beard, and a battered hat was digging a hole. A sapling rested on the ground, its root ball in a burlap sack. Grover recognized the fan-shaped ginkgo leaves. "Another one?" The man set down his shovel and came over to look at Grover's weaving, which they had rested gently on the ground. He squatted down, looking it over closely. Jesse, a landscaper, did a lot of work for the cemetery and lived three doors down from Grover's family. He'd become close friends with Grover's parents long before Grover was ever born. Sometimes Grover went on jobs with Jesse, helping him weed or plant shrubs or mulch flower beds. Jesse told wild stories about growing up poor in Charleston. He had a way about him that made Grover think of Yoda, Yoda with a southern accent. Jesse walked around to the other side with Biscuit following him. Some intricate work here. Grover felt his face heat up with embarrassment. He respected Jesse's opinion. Biscuit sniffed the weaving. "It'll look good with the others," Jesse said. "I went to straighten up over there a little bit this morning, but I saw that you beat me to it." Grover shook his head. "I haven't straightened it." "Me neither," Sudie said. "Oh, I bet it was Matthew," Jesse said. "He's my new assistant. I've got him working over in that area this morning." Jesse often hired assistants from the University of North Carolina, Asheville, to help him part-time. "Has your daddy seen this one?" Jesse nodded at the weaving. "He's at the office," Sudie said. "As usual," Grover couldn't help adding. Their father had always gone over to the Thomas Wolfe house on Saturdays and sometimes Sundays to catch up on paperwork. What surprised Grover was that he'd started back working weekends only a couple of weeks after the accident. At first, he thought it was his father's way of dealing with it all, throwing himself into his work. But lately, he'd kept even longer hours. From overheard conversations, Grover had gathered that the Wolf house was in some kind of trouble. So he couldn't tell where his father's sadness stopped and his worry about the Wolf house started. "Your father has a big job," Jesse said. "A lot of people count on him." It was something their mother used to say when their father didn't show up for a soccer game or meet your teacher night or the fall fling. Grover picked up the weaving and walked away. Sudie ran after Grover with Biscuit behind her. She took up her end of the weaving. They passed a worn headstone with a little statue of a lamb curled up on it. A lamb or any kind of animal meant a child's grave. Lily Starbuck, 1910 to 1918. Grover had noticed many graves of people who died in 1918. Their father had said a lot of people had died then because of the Spanish flu, spread by soldiers coming back from World War I. At the top of the hill was Thomas Wolfe's grave, surrounded by his family's graves, his mother, his father, and his brothers and sisters. Wolfe's marker read, "Tom, son of W.O. and Julia E. Wolfe, a beloved American author, October 3, 1900 to September 15, 1938. The last voyage, the longest, the best. Look homeward, angel." A couple of folded notes rested on the bottom ledge of Wolfe's marker. People often left cards and even letters to Wolfe. The notes usually praised his books. Sometimes there would be a note from someone sounding desperate. Their boyfriend had just broken up with them, or their wife had cancer, or their father had died of a heart attack. Grover and Sudie arrived at the Johnston family plot, mostly old, worn gray markers, some newer-looking than others. Their grandparents, their father's parents, were buried here, great-aunts and uncles. A white marble marker gleamed in one corner. Propped against the marker were all sizes of bamboo weavings with leaves and grasses and bark woven together. The first ones were the smallest. They'd faded and started to come unraveled. Not really aware he was doing it, Grover had made each weaving a little bigger. They leaned against all sides of the grave marker, covering everything but the inscription, Jean Caroline Johnston, March 10th, 1967 to April 6th, 2011. We are not what we think. The Buddha. More weavings covered the ground around the marker like a gigantic quilt. Sudi helped Grover move the most recent weavings to the side and set the new one at the foot of the marker. Several plots away, a man in a green army jacket raked around several headstones. Grover guessed this was Matthew, Jesse's new assistant. "She'll like your new weaving," Sudi said, resting her hand on the marker. Grover watched his sister's face darken. "Now you said..."
"I know. I won't."
Her lip trembled. "We better go," Grover said, starting to take his sister's hand. But she jerked away. "God is stupid," Sudi said. Grover sighed. "Not him again." "Well, he is," she said louder. "If he can't think of anything better than having everybody die in the end." Crows lifted from a leafless dogwood, and Matthew had stopped raking and was looking in their direction. He was chubby, pale, and wore thick-lensed, black-framed glasses. "Keep your voice down," Grover said. "Well, God is stupid," Sudi said, "and I don't care who hears it." Her shoulders slumped, and she sank down on the ground beside their mother's headstone. She clutched a tiny silver cylinder that hung from a necklace that she never took off. Grover had kept his in his dresser drawer. He sat down beside his sister, but didn't say anything. Sudi wiped her nose on her coat sleeve. "It just seems so..." Then she said softly, "Stupid." "You won't get any argument from me," Grover said. "Is that how come you don't believe in God?" Sudi asked, petting Biscuit. "Partly," Grover said. "Mostly," is what he should have said. "Mostly, he didn't believe in God because their mother was dead." Since then, he'd paid closer attention in school when they'd studied the slaughter of the Indians, the horrors of slavery, the nightmare of the Holocaust, the bombing of Hiroshima. Not to mention all the wars that ever were. The evidence had been there all along. He'd just been too happy to see it. "I've been dreaming again." Sudi was looking at the headstone, her eyes rimmed in red. "Same dream?" he asked. "Daddy pulls over, asks Mama if she wants a ride, and she gets in the car with us, and I think everything is going to be okay. She climbs into the back seat between you and me, holding our hands. Daddy drives home, turns onto Edgemont, pulls in front of the house. I turn around, and she's gone," he said, in an almost bored tone. "I've had that dream 100 times, she said. "Every time I tell myself, this time I'm going to hold her hand tighter." "Sudi, nobody can hold that tight." She bit her lip, and for a minute Grover worried she might start sniffling again. He hated when she cried, when anybody cried, for that matter. He never knew what to do. "My butt's getting cold," Grover said, standing up. "Let's go home." Sudi looked up at him. "Come on." He motioned for her to stand. "Maybe this old house is on." "That doesn't come on till 3, she said, getting up. "The new Yankee Workshop is on right now." The only TV channel they'd ever been able to get with their antenna was public TV. Their mother had never allowed cable. Never allowed them to play video games. Never allowed them to have a computer in the house. She believed children were losing the ability to entertain themselves. She said it was something she'd noticed over the years at her job. But her rules went for their father, too. He had to leave his laptop at the office. One of the biggest fights Grover could remember his parents ever having, and they didn't have many, happened on a night when their father had smuggled his laptop into the house, and their mother had caught him in the kitchen late at night checking his email. They found Jesse trying to lift the sapling with its heavy root ball. He looked at Sudie, who was still sniffling a little bit. "Can y'all help me tote this to the hole?" Sudie nodded, and the three of them lifted the sapling and set it into the hole. "I'll take it from here," he said, shoveling dirt around it. Sudie and Grover walked out of the cemetery entrance with Biscuit leading the way, and as they did, the wind picked back up. They were passing by the bamboo forest when Sudie stopped. "Do you think God's mad at me for calling him stupid?" "If there is a God," Grover said, "he'd be a pretty sorry one to get bent out of shape because some girl in a little town in the middle of nowhere called him stupid." "I'm not some girl," Sudie said. "I'm Sudie Johnston, and this isn't the middle of nowhere. It's Asheville, North Carolina." "If God spent his time jumping on people every time somebody called him something," Grover said, "he'd never get anything done." Grover was relieved his sister didn't say anything else. These God talks tired him out. With their mother dead and their father gone so much, Grover needed Sudie to believe in God. It took some pressure off him. Also, a microscopic cell of himself wondered if he was wrong, if maybe there was a God. Even if he couldn't manage to believe, he liked to think that his sister believed enough for the both of them. Chapter 2. No One Left to Blame. On a Saturday morning, 1 week later, Grover smelled the sandalwood. He'd been working on a new weaving in his workshop in the bamboo forest. He'd reached into the shoebox and pulled out a blood-red sugar maple leaf. He carefully worked it in with the other leaves, then stepped back, blew into his hands to warm his fingers, and looked at his work. He breathed in. There it was, the unmistakable, sweet, smoky smell. His mother had burned sandalwood incense every morning at her altar upstairs. He looked around, but saw nothing except bamboo. He pictured how it used to be in their house every morning. Their father, a thin, balding man with bright eyes, made even brighter somehow by his thick, bushy eyebrows. He moved easily around the kitchen, cracking eggs, stirring grits, and turning over the bacon that buckled and shriveled in the frying pan. Upstairs, their mother sat straight-backed on a little round cushion, chanting and ringing her brass bowl. In front of a fat, smiling little wooden Buddha. When their father called them all to breakfast, she would come downstairs in her robe and sit at the kitchen table smelling like sandalwood. Grover looked through the shoebox of leaves. Red oak, tulip poplar, basswood, ash, beech, sycamore, Japanese maple, red maple, sugar maple, paper birch, and weeping cherry. He picked out a narrow, yellow birch leaf and worked it in. He'd gotten up early this morning, on a Saturday evening, put on a coat and hat, and headed out to the bamboo forest just after daybreak. The weaving, his biggest yet, was about half finished. It hung from a section of bamboo that he tied at eye level between two bamboo stalks. The more leaves he'd worked into it, the more the weaving caught the morning breeze, lifting and falling as if it breathed. Loud caws, shadows glided through the air, black, shiny wings. Something had startled the crows. They settled back into the bamboo, flapping and cawing. A couple of years ago, he'd found the dangling skeleton of a crow that had somehow gotten caught in the bamboo and hung itself. The bamboo forest took up half a vacant lot next to Grover's house. The half without bamboo was a field that kids sometimes played softball or football in. The rest was bamboo, a maze of footpaths worn by generations of kids' feet. Grover had been coming here since he was old enough to walk. Years ago, his mother had given him a small bow saw and a Swiss Army knife, and he'd made spears, blowguns, bows, and arrows. He learned how to lash the bamboo to make chairs, tables, fences, and gates. As he got older, Grover didn't come as much to the bamboo forest. Like his friends, he rode his bike or skateboarded or went inside and watched TV. But for the past 6 months, all he'd wanted to do, all he could stand to do, really, was go outside and put things together. Sticks, grass, leaves, anything he could get his hands on. Something whizzed over his head. He heard a crack, looked up, and saw his weaving crumpled on the ground. A soccer ball rolled to a stop beside him as someone came crashing through the bamboo. A small boy with big ears and freckles stepped into the clearing. "Whoa, I didn't know this was back here," he said. "This yours?" Grover held up the soccer ball. His heart pounded. "I was practicing with my left foot," the boy said. "What is this back here? A hideout or something?" Grover threw the ball hard at the boy, then picked up the weaving, which had been torn from the section of bamboo it had been tied to, but otherwise looked okay. He turned over the weaving, gently running his hand over it. "What is this place?" the boy asked. "You almost smashed a month's work," Grover snapped. Well, technically a couple of weeks' worth, but he wanted the boy to feel bad about what could have happened. He turned the weaving over a couple more times, and when he saw it was okay, began to calm down. "What are you making?" This boy looked familiar. And his accent sounded familiar, too. "Is this your hideout?" He walked around the neat piles of bamboo, arranged by size and length. The piles of grasses, leaves, pine cones, and small branches from other trees. A bamboo lean-to occupied the middle of the clearing. Underneath the lean-to sat a small bamboo table and chair, where Grover worked when it rained. "It's my workshop," Grover said, picking out a bamboo section from the pile. "This isn't no workshop," the boy said. "This is outside." Grover opened a big toolbox. He had several handsaws, one with a curved blade, another with a big square blade, a couple with long narrow blades, some with large teeth, some with small. He had rubber bands, twine, string, electrician's tape, duct tape, nails, screws. He pulled out a big ball of twine, then took his Swiss Army knife, which he always kept oiled and sharpened, out of his pocket. He cut off four lengths of the twine and retied the weaving to the bamboo section it had been hanging from, then, with a couple more pieces of twine, retied the whole thing back to the bamboo stalks. The boy went up to the weaving, gently touching it. "Don't," Grover said. "You've done enough already." Holding his hands behind his back like he was in a museum, the boy studied the weaving, then looked around the clearing, then looked back at the weaving. "Now I get it," he said. "You're some kind of artist." The boy pointed at the weaving. "And this is your art." "I wouldn't call it art exactly," Grover said. The boy cocked his head one way and then the other as he studied the weaving. I'm not sure what else you could call it. Grover remembered where he'd seen the boy. One morning last week, Grover had been in the front yard looking for the Asheville Citizen Times when a tired-looking van pulling a very large U-Haul trailer rattled up to the house across the street, which Jesse owned but rented out. A mother and her two kids had climbed out of the van. The mother looked young to be somebody's mother, at least younger than Grover's mother. The kids were this round-faced, big-eared boy here, and a tall, dark girl with long black hair. After a while, a huge pickup had pulled in front of the rental house. It had a Confederate decal on the rear window, a Bread Not Bombs sticker on the bumper, and an umbrella in the gun rack. A man Grover guessed to be the father got out. He helped them unload the U-Haul, but then a couple of hours later, he climbed back in his truck, shouted, "So long, sis," to the woman, and drove off. Grover hadn't seen him since. Not that he'd paid much attention. Families came and went in the rental. It wasn't worth the effort to make friends with renters. One day you'd be playing with them, the next day they'd be gone. "Name's Clay," the boy held out his hand. "I'm real sorry about knocking down your art." Grover looked at the boy's hand. He'd never had another kid want to shake hands. "Grover," is all he said as he shook the boy's hand. "Grover? Now that's an interesting name. A mighty interesting name. Don't believe I know a single soul with that name." "I have a cousin named Sturgis, but I've never met a Grover. I'm trying to finish this." Grover bent down to his shoebox. "Oh, sure, Grover," he said. "You go right ahead. Don't mind me. I don't like people watching me work." "Don't blame you, Grover," he said. "I'll be quiet as a mouse." Grover turned on the boy, but something in his eyes, something easy and open, made it hard to stay mad. Grover sighed, then turned back to his work. He wove a birch leaf into the bamboo, then bent down to pick out another leaf. Clay bent down with him, peering into the shoebox. "Where'd you get all the leaves, Grover?" "Back home, we learned that it's when the chlorophyll drains out that you get your colors." "A funny thing, if you think about it. You don't know a leaf's true colors till it's dead." Grover shot the boy a look. Clay put his finger to his lips, then whispered, "Quiet as a mouse, Grover." Grover went back to his weaving, surprised the boy knew a word like chlorophyll. He searched for another leaf in the shoebox. He'd always used his mother's shoeboxes to bury his pets that had died over the years. 3 salamanders, a frog, a turtle, too many goldfish to count, and a guinea pig. When he'd gone into his mother's closet a few weeks ago to get this shoebox, his heart had begun to pound. The silent stacks of shoeboxes made him feel like he'd stepped into a mausoleum. Grover wasn't sure how much time had passed when he reached into the shoebox for another leaf and found it empty. He noticed the sun overhead. Noon already? He'd been working for 5 hours. He looked around for Clay, but Clay was gone. With his stomach growling, he headed home for lunch. Grover lived with his father and Sudie in a green, 2-story, 100-year-old house. Grover's room faced out on the bamboo forest. From his downstairs window, all he could see was the calm, cool green of bamboo stalks. Sudie's downstairs room looked on to a bright goldfish pond with tall grasses growing on the far side. Sudie, who'd always been a late riser, sat on the couch in her pink flannel pajamas, watching a cooking show and eating a grapefruit half. Biscuit was curled up on the couch beside her. on TV, a man wearing an apron who spoke with a French accent chopped up a red pepper so fast it was a blur. "Daddy gone to work already?" Grover asked. He went out to the kitchen and made a peanut butter and honey, then sat on the couch with Sudie and watched the man, who was named Jacques Pepin, chop up a few more vegetables and toss them into a skillet. Watching the chef pull a brown loaf of bread out of the oven, Grover noticed the dusty DVD player underneath the TV. It was one of the few technological things their mother had let them have, because, she said, they could watch movies as a family. And last year, their mother had surprised everyone. By giving Grover an iPod for his birthday, making him promise to use it only at bedtime, it was to replace the worn CD player he'd kept on his nightstand. Ever since he was little, he'd needed music to go to sleep. Sudie squeezed grapefruit juice into her spoon. Their mother had had to make her eat fruits and vegetables. Now, Sudie ate a grapefruit every morning, packed her school lunchbox with carrots, peppers, and apples, or grapes, and made sure they all had at least two vegetables for dinner. Sudie had been like that with a lot of things. Their mother had always been after Sudie to make her bed and pick up her room. Now, Sudie kept her room as neat as a pin. After Grover ate his sandwich, he took his sisters and his plates out to the kitchen, rinsed them off, and put them in the dishwasher. When he came back, he told Sudie he was going back to his workshop. "I want to see how it's coming," Sudie said, turning off the TV. "Can you wait a second while I change out of my PJs?" While he waited, Grover roamed the front yard, looking for the morning paper in the tall grass. Their mother had been the one to keep up the yard. Now the grass and the hedges had gotten out of hand. Grover cut it himself every now and then. But one day, Sudie had been watching a program on the show Nature about letting your grass and hedges grow to make your yard a home for birds and small animals. "We're a refuge," she said, and sent off for a little plastic sign that said Certified Backyard Wilderness. She hung it from the abelia bush, which had grown to the size of a VW bug. Grover didn't bother mowing after that. A couple of crows cawed from the maple, flew away, and settled in an overgrown nandina. Sudie came out dressed and wearing a coat, and Biscuit followed behind her. As they walked over to the bamboo forest, she said, "How come you don't show Daddy your weavings?" "He never asked to see them," Grover said. "When he's busy with work," she said, "he forgets about everything else." The truth was that their father had never seemed to think much of the things Grover made. More than once, he'd overheard his parents argue about him. His mother saying that Grover was talented and had vision. His father replying that might be true, but that the boy could be a good student if he spent half the time studying that he spent in the bamboo forest. "He is a good student," his mother would say. But he knew what his father had meant. He wanted Grover to be like Sudie, born making A's. The longer his mother had been dead, the more his father had seemed to worry about Grover's grades. When Grover received a couple of C's on English papers a few weeks ago, his father started making Grover and Sudie walk over to the Wolf House so he could check his homework. Now Grover was only able to work in the bamboo forest after supper, and only after he showed his father his completed homework. With daylight savings switching back to regular time in a couple of weeks, it'd be dark after supper, and then how would he work in the bamboo forest? "What is that?" Sudie walked over to a stake on the edge of the bamboo forest. It had a red ribbon tied to it. There's another, and another. A pit opened up in his stomach as Grover saw that stakes had been driven in along the edges of the bamboo forest. He hadn't noticed these this morning. He'd been too busy working on the weaving. Or someone had put them in the ground while he was eating lunch. "What do they mean?" Sooty asked. "I don't know," he said. He sounded miles away from himself. He remembered the afternoon his father had been driving him and his sister home from soccer practice. They'd seen their mother walking along Charlotte Street, with Biscuit trotting ahead of her on the sidewalk. Their father pulled over, rolled down his window, and asked if she needed a ride. She shook her head and said she was going to Video Life to pick up a movie, and that she and Biscuit both needed the walk. "See you in a little bit," she said, as they pulled away. Something made Grover turn around and look back out the car windshield at his mother. She waved. He didn't wave back. He'd started to. Probably every time she'd ever waved at him before, he'd waved back. But this time, he'd felt childish, embarrassed that someone might see him wave to his mother. Besides, why wave goodbye to someone he was going to see in 45 minutes? "Grover," Sooty said, tugging on his coat sleeve, "what do the stakes mean?" "I said I don't know." He bent down and took hold of the stake. He tried to jiggle it, but it didn't move. It must have been put pretty deep in the ground. He tried to pull it up, but it wouldn't give. He tried again, this time with both hands, and remembered reading in The Once and Future King how the boy Arthur strained to pull the sword from the stone. With a couple more tugs, Grover slid the stake out of the ground and held it up. Sooty tried to pull up the next one. Feeling bad about yelling at his sister, Grover went over and tugged on it. "Give it a try now," he said, letting her pull it the rest of the way out of the ground. They went all around the edge of the bamboo forest, him loosening the stakes and Sooty pulling them out. In the end, they each had an armful. "What'll we do with them?" Sooty asked. Grover thought about piling them up in his workshop. He could make something out of them. That was a stupid idea. Whoever put them there in the first place might find them. So he and Sooty started home with them, keeping an eye out for anyone who might see them. "What y'all got there?" They hadn't seen Clay juggling the soccer ball in front of his house. He'd stopped when he saw them and ran across the street. "Oh, no," Grover groaned. "Not that kid." "Clay?" Sooty said. "You know him. I've kicked around a soccer ball with him a couple of times. He's all right." Clay trotted up to them. "What y'all toting?" Grover realized the boy's accent was like the people up in the mountains where his family went to get their Christmas tree every year. "Somebody put stakes in the bamboo forest," Sooty said, holding up her armful. "Sooty," Grover hissed. "Surveyors," Clay said. "Saw them over there yesterday." "You did?" Grover asked. "I want to be a surveyor when I grow up," Clay said, bending down to pet Biscuit. "You get to be outdoors, not cooped up in some old office all day. My daddy was a surveyor." He glanced at the stakes. "Those boys are going to be none too happy about you pulling those up. If I was you, I'd do a mighty good job of hiding them, maybe even destroy the evidence." Grover and Sooty went inside with the stakes, and Clay started to follow them, but Grover said, "See you later," and shut the door on him. "That kid doesn't take a hint," Grover said, dropping his stakes on the floor. "He's just being friendly," Sooty said, piling hers on top of Grover's. "There's a fine line between being friendly and being a pest," Grover said. "There's a fine line between being nice and being rude." Sooty stood at the window, watching Clay walk back across the street. He He might tell somebody we pulled up the stakes, Grover said.
He's not like that, Sudie said.
You better hope you're right, Grover said. He had to admit that even if Sudie was his little sister and 2 years younger, she had a sixth sense about people. If she thought Clay would keep his mouth shut, he probably would.
What are we going to do with all these? Sudie asked, towing the pile of stakes.
We can't leave them here or Daddy'll find out. Grover studied the wood stove that sat in the middle of the den. Their father heated with it as much as possible to cut the oil bill. Every summer, Jesse brought a load of wood that his father loved to split and stack at the side of the house.
Be back in a second. Grover ran out into the yard, snapping some dead twigs off the abelia bush and the privet hedge. His father had taught him that the best kindling came from the bottom of bushes and trees, where it was kept dry by the limbs above. Coming from under the abelia, Grover saw Matthew, Jesse's assistant, in his army coat and wearing a backpack, walking in the direction of the cemetery. Grover waved, but Matthew didn't wave back. He couldn't tell if Matthew was ignoring him or just hadn't seen him. Back inside, Grover set the twigs by the wood stove, and as he balled up some newspaper, asked Sudie to bring the stakes over to him.
"What are you doing?"
She carried over an armful of stakes and dropped them beside him.
"Destroying the evidence."
He arranged the twigs in a miniature teepee over the ball of newspaper, then lighted a match to the newspaper. When the fire was going good, he stacked the stakes on top. The new wood popped and snapped, sending sparks out into the room, which Sudie was quick to stomp on. Sudie sat back down beside him. Both watched the stakes flame up inside the wood stove.
"Did you hear what Clay said about his daddy?" she asked.
Grover paused. "That he was a surveyor?"
"That he was," she said.
"Probably has some other job now," Grover said.
"He was a surveyor. Now he's a plumber or a lawyer or a doctor or something."
"There's no father over there now," she said.
"Maybe he's finishing his job somewhere," Grover said. "They moved ahead of him to get settled."
"Maybe," she said. Grover watched his sister watch the fire. He and Sudie had become parent detectors, sensing whether a kid had a full set of parents, if their parents were married or divorced, alive, or every now and then not. After he'd fed the last steak to the fire, he closed the door to the stove and turned the damper down so it'd burn steady. There was a scratch at the front door and a bark. Grover opened the door for Biscuit, who trotted in and jumped onto the couch. He was about to close the front door when he noticed Clay's big sister across the street, sitting on the cinder block steps, reading. Had she been there the whole time? She sat like he'd often seen her, with her legs crossed, Indian style, her elbows on her knees, and her head bowed over a book in her lap. He closed the door. Sudie had turned on the TV and sat down on the couch with Biscuit. This old house was on.
"Maybe they won't put any more of those stakes in the bamboo forest," Sudie said.
Grover knew that pulling up a few stakes wouldn't stop whoever from doing whatever they planned. He almost said that, and in the old days, when their mother was there, he would have. When she was alive, he could say out loud what he was thinking. He could test out his worries. Now he fought to keep his worries not only from his sister, but from himself. He sat down with Sudie, and Biscuit whined at Grover.
"He wants you to pet him," Sudie said.
"I don't feel like it," Grover said.
"It's not his fault, Grover," she said. "You can't blame Biscuit."
"I don't." He petted Biscuit. But Sooty was kind of right. Every time he saw Biscuit, he pictured him running into traffic and their mother running after him. The police had determined that the driver hadn't been speeding, yet hadn't had time to stop. Grover did his best to watch the TV. Men with New England accents were fixing up a 200-year-old farmhouse. He liked this show. He liked seeing the old houses brought back to life. But after a while, what happened was what sometimes happened when he watched TV. He saw what the TV saw. This afternoon, what the TV saw was him and Sooty huddled on the couch with Biscuit between them, the three of them adrift in the living room. Chapter 3. He's Not Himself. That night, Grover walked with Sooty down Edgemont as streetlights buzzed and flickered on. Their father had called and said that he'd meet them at Jesse's. It had turned much colder that afternoon. Grover and Sooty wore sweaters that smelled like the cedar chest. For the first time this fall, Grover had had to get his and his sister's sweaters out of the chest in the upstairs hallway. He'd always loved the dark chest that had first belonged to their grandmother's grandmother and had been protecting Johnston sweaters from moths for generations. Its bright smell was old and safe. As he dug through the folded sweaters, he stopped. Last Easter, like she had every Easter, their mother had carefully folded the family sweaters and put them away. He remembered walking past her as she sat there, setting sweaters into the chest. At the time, he hadn't thought a thing about it. But now he knelt beside the chest, stroking the sweaters, holding them to his face, breathing in their bright cedar smell. As Grover and Sooty walked down the street, leaves blew along the sidewalk, making a dry, scrambling sound. In the distance, dogs gave test barks to see if other dogs were out there. Grover had always liked fall with its cold and its early dark. He liked seeing into the lighted rooms of neighbors' houses. He liked watching them cook or sit down to supper or watch TV together. He wondered if his neighbors knew what they had, how quick they could lose it, how in 1 millisecond it could all be gone. Gone. The word couldn't have sounded more like itself. Not there anymore, boiled down to a single syllable, a solitary word. Gone. A word Grover had felt in his bones ever since that late afternoon in April, when she hadn't come back from her walk. Biscuit had shown up, his broken leash trailing behind. Their father had been on the phone to Video Life when they'd heard sirens. Grover and Sooty walked up Jesse's stone walk, lined by leaf-shaped lights. Jesse lived in a small, old Spanish stucco house with an arched front porch, a red-tiled roof, and big, wavy glass windows that shimmered tonight with candlelight from inside. His yard stayed neat, the grass mowed, the shrubs trimmed, the beds mulched. Still, he wasn't like some of the neighbors who Grover's father called yard Nazis. Neighbors, most of them old, with not much else to do except watch over their yards, swooping down on kids if they set foot on their lawns. They found Jesse in the kitchen, turning over pieces of chicken, sizzling in a frying pan. Without his big hat, he looked smaller. He tied his long gray hair back in a ponytail and wore an apron that had printed in big, bold letters across it. "The South shall rise again," and under the words was a drawing of a plateful of biscuits. Jesse already had several golden brown pieces of chicken draining on a paper towel on the counter. Daddy said he'd meet us here, Sudie said. Tippy and Merlin, Jesse's two cats, rubbed against their legs. Tippy was strictly an indoor cat. Merlin spent the day outside but came in at night. Merlin liked to slip into neighbors' houses when they weren't looking. He tried slipping into Grover's house but stopped after Biscuit had chased him out a few times. "If y'all will set the table and fill the tea glasses," Jesse said, checking the rice in a pot on the stove. Grover and Sudie went to work, knowing which drawer held the silverware, which cabinets held the plates and glasses. Jesse and their parents had been friends so long that he felt like one of the family. They'd always eaten at Jesse's on Saturday nights. Over the past 6 months, they'd eaten even more at Jesse's. At least Grover and Sudie had. Grover had gotten down the plates and filled the tea glasses, and Sudie'd set out the silverware and napkins when their father walked in. He had on his tweed coat and a loosened tie. His face was dark with evening stubble, and he frowned to himself. He bent down and absent-mindedly petted the cats. "Help yourself," Jesse said, nodding to the refrigerator. Their father took a brown bottle of beer out of the refrigerator and opened it with the First Baptist of Asheville Church church key magnet on the side of the refrigerator. "Daddy, Grover's making his best weaving yet," Sudie said. "Another amazing one," said Jesse, who stopped by Grover's workshop now and then. "To tell you the truth, I haven't seen anything quite like Grover's weavings." Their father smiled vacantly as he pulled out a chair and sat at the kitchen table. He sipped his beer, then set the bottle down and looked at it. He'd always had circles under his eyes, but they'd become almost black, like all his worries had pooled there. "How are things at work?" Jesse asked, lifting the lid on the pot of rice, then replacing it. Their father looked up. "Hmm? How are things at the old Kentucky home?" Jesse asked. That was the name of the Wolf House, the boarding house that Thomas Wolfe's mother had run and where Wolfe had lived some as a boy. Wolfe had divided his time between his father's house and his mother's boarding house a few blocks away. "I met with the county manager last week," their father said, taking a sip of beer. "She says that with the economy the way it is, they have to make cuts where they can, and that they can't cut schools or essential services." "Essential services?" Sudie asked. "Like the fire department or the garbage pickup," Grover said. "The Thomas Wolfe House is an essential service," Sudie said. "I'd like to think so," their father said, smiling that vacant smile again. "But the county manager said if we can't get attendance up by the end of the year, they'll have to cut our budget in half." "In half?" Jesse asked. "I'll have to lay off staff. And if I lay off staff, we'll have to cut back hours. And if we cut back hours, we'll have even fewer visitors. And pretty soon they won't just be cutting our budget, they'll be closing us down." He took another swig of his beer. "And I, along with a lot of other folks, will be out of a job." "It won't come to that," Jesse said. "Delbert Lunsford has been talking to the other commissioners about replacing me." "Nobody listens to him," Jesse said. "Somebody must," their father said. "He manages to get elected every couple of years." The upstairs of the Wolf House had burned several years ago. Somebody, they never found out who, had thrown a burning rag through an upstairs window in the middle of the night. Grover had been too young to remember the fire, but he did remember the big blue tarp that stayed draped over the burned roof for years. Delbert Lunsford, a longtime commissioner and a realtor, had had it in for their father ever since he'd organized opposition to Lunsford's idea to bulldoze the burned house and sell the land to a hotel chain. Instead of being bulldozed, the house had been restored with money their father had raised over several years. Before the fire, the house had been a plain, ugly, run-down old white house. Grover had seen pictures. The restoration, which came some years after the fire, brought new life to the house. His father had worked hard to bring the house back to how it first looked. Outside, it had been painted bright yellow, and inside, all the furniture, all the walls, all the floors had been restored to their new old selves. Their mother liked to say it was a reincarnation. Still, with the house closed so long, attendance had never recovered. Jesse served everyone's plates in the kitchen. The four of them sat down to eat. Jesse reached for Grover's and Sudie's hands, and their father took their hands too. Everyone bowed their heads except Grover. "Lord," Jesse said, bowing his head, "we thank you for this sustenance. Amen." Grover liked Jesse's blessings, short and sweet. Not like Aunt Paula, their father's sister. Her blessings went on so long, their food would have to be taken back into the kitchen to be reheated. But it had been good to have Aunt Paula around for their mother's funeral, breaking up the weepy silence of all the red-eyed mourners with her loud sobbing, her swooning and swaying over the coffin, and her crying out for Jesus to welcome her precious sister-in-law into his sweet embrace. They'd been eating a while, and Jesse had their father cracking up with a story about a wealthy widow who was 20 years older and whose yard he'd landscaped for years. The other day, she'd said her house was too big to be alone in and asked Jesse if he'd like to shack up with her. Their father laughed. "Shack up? Her very words," Jesse said, raising his hand like he was taking an oath. "And what did you say?" their father asked. "I said I appreciated the offer, but that I was looking for more of a commitment." Their father laughed again. Grover'd always liked eating at Jesse's. Since their mother died, he'd liked it even more. Jesse could always make their father laugh. "Someone put stakes in the bamboo forest," Sudie said. Stunned at his sister's timing, Grover glared at her across the table. "What?" she silently mouthed. "I haven't seen any stakes," Jesse said. "Well, they're not there now," Sudie said. Grover let his head drop to his chest. "I wonder if he's finally selling," their father said, setting down a drumstick and wiping his fingers with his napkin. "Wouldn't be surprised," Jesse said. "I've heard his daughter might be pressing him for the money. She has two kids going to college." "With the price of land in Asheville these days," their father said, taking a swig from his beer, "it's got to be worth at least $100,000. "I'd say twice that," Jesse said. "Wait a minute," Grover said. "Somebody owns the bamboo forest?" In all the years he'd worked in the bamboo forest, never had it occurred to him that anyone might own it. How could anybody own the bamboo forest? It was like someone owning the sky, or the clouds, or the sun. Even today, when he'd seen those stakes, it hadn't registered that anyone might own the bamboo forest. "Maybe he's just having the property reappraised," Jesse said. "Who owns it?" Grover asked. "Lunsford," Jesse said. "The commissioner?" Grover asked, looking at their father. "He owns a lot of land around Asheville," their father said. "He can't sell the bamboo forest," Grover said, sounding panicked. This reading of What I Came to Tell You by Tommy Hayes will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina.